welcome to this next edition of our UKIS ITEL podcast from UK in a Changing Europe. I'm delighted today to be joined by Rosie Collington, who is a PhD candidate at UCL. She's got an MSc in political science from the University of Copenhagen and has written for Inter Alia, The Guardian, New Statesman and Open Democracy. And Rosie is here to talk about her new book, which is written with Mariana Mazzucato, The Big Con. Welcome, Rosie.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's a fascinating book. I'd recommend it to all our listeners as a very sort of interesting and easy read. But just to kick us off, do you want to sort of summarise what you're arguing in the book?
Absolutely. So in the book, we look at the growth of what we term the consulting industry. We focus in the book on the big three and the big four companies. These are the terms that are kind of used within the sector and in academia. Mm-hmm. So the big three, that some of these will be household names in some households. So the big three is McKinsey, Bain & Company and Boston Consulting Group. And the big four are companies that historically have had their roots in accounting. And that's Deloitte, KPMG, PwC and Ernst & Young. Now, over the past couple decades, globally, the consulting market and the kind of this industry that we look at in the book has grown massively. It's very difficult to estimate exactly how big it is today, but the kind of best guess that we have, or the best bets that we have, are that it is between $700 and $900 billion dollars globally in 2021. So it's pretty big. I read a stat yesterday in a Danish newspaper, in a Danish review on the book, that said that was twice the GDP of Denmark. So that is pretty big. And in the book, we interrogate why this sector has grown so much and what that can tell us about capitalism and the transformation of the economy over the past couple of decades. And I guess the kind of core argument is actually in the subtitle of the book, how the consulting industry weakens our businesses, infantilizes our governments and warps our economies.
Brilliant. Thank you. I mean, there are a lot of fascinating case studies in the book. There's the case of Puerto Rico. One I found sort of quite remarkable was that of the hospital NKS in Stockholm. Mm-hmm. I mean, could you just talk us briefly through one of those case studies, just to give an illustration of what it is you're getting at in the book? It doesn't have to be one of those, any that come to mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, so the Puerto Rico case study that we look at in the book is pretty fascinating. So your listeners might be familiar with the history or the politics of Puerto Rico. It's part of the United States, but that in itself, its relationship with the United States is a bit tricky. And that's part of what we look at in the book. And in 2014, Puerto Rico experienced a massive financial crisis. And as part of this, the US government kind of intervened and at the national level, and was providing support and advice through this kind of local committee that was based on the ground, which then contracted McKinsey as its kind of key economic advisor to help with the restructuring of the economy in Puerto Rico. And the kind of things that they were advising on, the kind of things that they were advising the government to do there, were things like privatization of welfare services, kind of cutting public sector budgets, the kind of policies that we have come to associate with neoliberalism, or Thatcher and Reagan and politicians that have come after them and have kind of adopted similar politics. So what we've seen in the UK in kind of post 2010 austerity politics, and this was an issue for a few reasons. One of them was that when Hurricane Maria struck the island in 2017, it was found that a lot of the infrastructure, a lot of the healthcare infrastructure, for example, that would have been really important as part of the recovery and ensuring that many people weren't affected, just wasn't there in the way that it could have been. And some people pointed to the advice that McKinsey had given as kind of part of this. But the kind of bigger issue was that McKinsey, via an investment arm, which is kind of legally separate, or is supposed to be legally separate to McKinsey, also had investments in Puerto Rico's debt that meant that it was going to benefit from the restructuring process. So there was this huge conflict of interest. Now, McKinsey said, you know, there is a Chinese wall between these two parts of our company, But actually, the US government found that that wasn't the case. And has kind of challenged that decision. And I mean, you know, in any case, what we argue in the book is that when these conflicts of interest do arise, and the kind of conflicts of interest that we're really interested in the book are not these direct conflicts of interest where the companies themselves have necessarily kind of investments. That's not super common in the sector, but are kind of more systemic or might be more to do with the types of advice that they're providing governments, for example, while they're also consulting companies that governments are trying to regulate. Even if these kind of issues don't manifest in conflicts of interest, the risk of them is certainly something that citizens want to know about and should know about as part of, you know, how they hold their governments and their government's decisions to account.
I mean, this strikes me as a key theme. It sort of recurs in many, many different ways, this conflict of interest theme throughout the book. But one of the things that really caught my attention is the argument that because consultancies make a hell of a lot more money from private clients than they do from governments, their interests are always to serve those private clients as well as possible. And that taints the way they give advice to governments. That's to say, they will give advice to governments in such a way as to maximize the revenues that their private clients can get from governments. So is that a fair assessment? I mean, is there that sort of private sector bias to everything they do, which, for instance, speaks to their role in privatizations and such?
Yeah, so this is a good question because it also gets to something that we're asked a lot about, which is, are we talking about every single case of a consultant advising government or every single case of a consultancy advising a company? No, we're not. We're talking about tendencies and the imperatives and that exist and kind of propel the industry and the kind of business. And this is a factor of the business models that these companies have. They exist and they are able to grow by securing contracts from clients, which is quite different to, for example, how a university professor providing advice or even many think tanks are funded and how they receive their income. Now, as you've suggested, they do, that the biggest clients are in the private sector, but these companies do receive a lot of contracts from the public sector. And in many countries, this has grown a lot. In the UK, this is somewhere that's grown a lot. They also receive a lot of income from kind of intergovernmental organisations or supranational organisations like the European Commission, which a European Commission report found last year. The European Commission had been relying on consultancies for up to £1 billion a year between, or spending that much between 2017 and 2022. Now, so in terms of the conflicts of interest, we can't point to every single case, of course, of where one of these companies has advised government and said, oh, they're clearly acting in the interests of a company. And of course, the clients that they have in the private sector and the consultancies themselves would deny any conflict of interest. They would say, we're always acting in the interests of clients. But when we look at some of their contracts, for example, where they have been advising governments on their net zero strategies and helping them do the analysis that kind of underpins these strategies, which often, you know, does not provide the solutions that might, for example, enable governments to reach net zero in the most effective way, but does so in a way that protects their fossil fuel clients at the same time, then it is important for us to, as citizens and as academics and as, you know, people in the media, to at least be able to ask these questions. You know, is this a conflict of interest?
And of course, they boast to their private sector clients about their links with government.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
So they use their links with government as a way of selling their services to private clients. Yeah. So, you know, there are grounds at least to be suspicious. Now, I mean, the central argument in the book, perhaps, is the argument about economic rents. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you could spend a couple of minutes sort of spelling that out. I mean, for non-economists among our audience, we like to think our audience are non-specialists. What are economic rents and how do consultancies benefit from them?
Yeah, so economic rents, the way that we define this is, I mean, I could go into all of the debates that exist within economics and political economy on,
please don't.
on how to define economic rents. If you're interested, if your readers are interested a bit more in these debates, then you could perhaps read one of Mariana's previous books, which is The Value of Everything, which talks about the issue of rents in our economy. The way that we define them in the book and the way that Mariana kind of uses them, defines rents in her wider work, is rents that are or income that is earned beyond the value that is created. Now, that's kind of a very simple term. What makes rents kind of possible, and what I guess is another defining characteristic of rents, is that the ability to earn this income beyond the value that is created is enabled because the company or the organization owns or has ownership over a particular, or a monopoly over a particular kind of assets, for example. So that could be intellectual assets, it could be data, it could be data infrastructure. What we kind of argue in the book is that what the consulting company has a monopoly, or what the consulting industry, sorry, the big three and the big four have a monopoly over, or have developed a monopoly over, is the reputation as these kind of objective brokers of expertise, this kind of neutral source of advice. And this reputation, you know, has not come about simply because these companies are actually a neutral source of advice and a kind of objective source of expertise or whatever, but actually because that they have invested in this over many decades, over many years, and continue to invest in creating the impression that they create value. That's a bit of a convoluted way of saying it. And this is how they are able to continue to secure income in this way. They're quite unique, or they are unique in our economies in that way.
But isn't, I mean, not to sound stupid, isn't value, you know, whatever value is, if you see what I mean? I mean, you might, you know, people at universities outside of Oxbridge might say, well, it's an utter farce to think that Oxbridge is so much better than everywhere else. It's just that they've had this reputation for centuries and they trade on that. Now, that might be true, but that is what gives them value. Now, we might say, actually, it really isn't value, but it's what the consumer thinks value is ultimately, isn't it? Governments fall for this, which means they must see some intrinsic value in it.
Great point. So what we show and what we argue is that even on the terms that the client kind of seeks the consulting companies out on, so how that client perceives value, whether that is increasing productivity within a company, which consultancies are often kind of good at being able to do, or if it is in the case of government, creating value for society through enabling the development of capacity or the kind of analysis that's underpinning a particular policy. These are kind of things that consultancies might be brought in for. Even on those terms, they aren't able to achieve this often. They aren't able to kind of achieve the things and create the kind of value that the client is seeking out. The other thing to kind of highlight is that the different roles that consultancies are put to in the economy vary enormously. So I'm going to use actually something that Andrew Sturdy, who's a professor at the University of Bristol, uses, which is the FEEL acronym, which is that they are facilitators, extras, experts, and legitimators. We use similar terms in the book, but I've since learned about Andrew Sturdy's FEEL. I can just walk through each of those. So facilitators is that they are brought in on the premise or the assumption that they are there to help kind of broker between different parts of an organization, perhaps, or facilitate the development of a strategy. When they're brought in as experts, it's because they're viewed as having some kind of specific kind of amazing advice, expert advice that is going to be useful to the organization. When they're brought in as extras, this is what we define in the book as outsourcers. It's because there is a kind of lack of capacity in an organization, and that client, that organization views that contracting the consultancy will help it to fill that gap. And when they're brought in as legitimators, this is perhaps the most interesting one from my perspective. It's because a politician, perhaps, or a business executive wants to pursue a policy program or a business decision, but that's perhaps very controversial and is met with some challenges within the organization. And so the consultancies are kind of recruited to help strengthen the position of that kind of internal person. One of the things that we look at in the book, so in terms of why they're actually brought in, then why if they're not creating value for society, perhaps, or not helping to kind of help governments to achieve their long-term policy ambitions. One of the reasons that we kind of focus on in the book for this is that governments, in using consultancies at scale and scope, which is really something that we can routine, the kind of third way, or we look at the third way, the 2000s, the new Labour years, as helping to legitimise and entrench this form of government, which is steering but not rowing, so coordinating societies but not doing so much itself. This has then created the hollowing out of capacity within government organisations, which creates a dependence on the need to continue using consultancies. We also look at how narratives about the superiority of the private sector vis-a-vis the public sector have also helped to shape this. So if government officials and politicians and civil servants are told all the time, you know, we have this big challenge like the pandemic, or we have this kind of innovation challenge as a society that we need to meet, but as governments, you know, like we're not the innovative ones, we should probably bring some people in from the private sector who are the innovative, exciting, clever, smart people. Yeah. All of these narratives then also feed into the decisions of governments, for example, to continue using consultancies, even if that's not, and often it is not, as we describe in the book, the kind of actually the best way to achieve these objectives.
And of course, the crucial point, I suppose, is that, you know, rowing can turn into steering quite easily.
Exactly, yeah.
There's a line between. There's a wonderful metaphor you use about psychotherapists, I think, that say, you know, it's like a psychotherapist that wants their patient to remain dependent so that they keep going back. And I think that's very powerful. But sort of panning out a little bit, do you think there is a legitimate role for these sorts of consultancies?
I think probably yes. But the issue is that, so there are a few different issues with this. We ask this question, I think, in every single interview. The kind of fundamental point when we think about these companies is that, of course, you know, we don't want governments and businesses, when they encounter a challenge, to just try to, you know, use knowledge that exists internally, if actually it can be very useful to look to other actors to help them confront this challenge. And often, of course, like a lot of knowledge exists outside of the organisations within government. We take for granted the kind of huge expertise and the knowledge and the experience that people develop as civil servants, having a long career or on the front line of the NHS, for example, or other kind of frontline public services. We take for granted this as a source of knowledge. But when governments do look externally for other sources of knowledge or for other expertise and experience that might help them confront a challenge, the baseline argument that we have is, you know, why is the default assumption to turn to these big consultancies? In some instances, yes, they might be best placed to help confront these challenges. They might have specific forms of expertise. But we look at many cases in the book where consultancies were brought in, particularly during the pandemic, for example, to help with things like procuring PPE in the UK or managing the logistics of the vaccine rollout in France, which was disastrous. And when you look at this, you think, well, why would Deloitte necessarily, you know, have the capabilities or have more capabilities than the NHS, for example, to develop and deliver a test and trace service?
So this is what people of my generation know as an intermission. So while you grab your Kia Aura and your vanilla ice cream, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, because there you'll figure out everything we're doing and get yourself places to our exciting range of events. Subscribe now. Isn't part of the answer, as it so often is to this sort of question, a sort of mixture of time and laziness? That is to say, sure, there's all sorts of sources of expertise out there. You know, I spend my life trying to convince people that, you know, they should talk to more academics and talk to more social scientists. The problem they often raise is they'll say, well, yeah, that's fine, but how the hell do we find them? And the beauty of a Deloitte or a McKinsey is they'll come in and say, we will fix this for you. You know, we will find the expertise. Just leave it to us. And there must be, I think, if you're a politician, particularly if you're a politician in a time of crisis like COVID, something very reassuring about some smartly dressed consultant walking into your office and saying, don't worry, we can take care of this for you. I mean, it must come as a massive relief apart from anything.
Absolutely.
Else.
But that doesn't mean that that's the right way to run the economy or the society. So, you know, of course, we can understand how these decision making processes happen. So we actually interviewed someone who had worked on Test and Trace with lots of the consultants who have been contracted and subcontracted by Deloitte during this program. And this person's kind of interpretation was that at the time that Deloitte was awarded these massive contracts at the outset of the pandemic, the government basically just wanted to be seen as doing something. You know, this was after a time where the UK had delayed lockdown relative to other countries, and COVID numbers were rising rapidly. And so government needed to be seen as, you know, spending a lot of money and almost kind of threw these massive contracts at Deloitte. But the consequences of this, as this kind of person we interviewed, and also as the Public Accounts Committee and government kind of inquiries into the COVID response have also looked at, was that this was a very inefficient way of responding to the pandemic that often created more challenges as it was trying to solve them. So we have this quote in the book. I wish I had the page open now, from this person who described all these zombie emails arriving all the time from what he described as Deloitte people who just simply didn't understand kind of the basic mechanisms and functioning of government. So they were sending kind of emails with very basic questions all the time, actually taking time away from the work that the people within government were trying to do.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, actually, one question I have to ask you is, have any of the big three or the big four invited you in to talk about the book?
No, and you know, I can tell you because it's been on the, I've done some interviews for a BBC Radio 4 series that's happening at the moment on consultancies, and this is something that we've encountered as well, that when we have invited them, or when members of the media have invited them to debate with us or speak with us or respond to things that we have said, they have refused to. So we think that's very interesting.
Okay, that is interesting. Yeah. Well, do let us know if one day they do ask you in, because that will be something worth watching, I imagine. The final substantive thing before we go a little bit broader is, I get the impression from the book that you're quite cynical about the corporate ESG agenda. Is that fair?
I think we both recognise that ESG can be a really important tool, could be a really important part or aspect of the green transition. You know, disclosure and mechanisms for encouraging companies to disclose emissions accurately is not the kind of whole solution, but it could be part of the solution. The issue is that this whole approach, and you know, since we've written this part of the book, which I think we first drafted at the end of 2021, there's barely a day in the Financial Times when ESG isn't being kind of lambasted for having failed miserably on its own terms for many of the reasons that we also talk about in the book. You know, I think we just agree that as an approach, it has been butchered and it has been used in ways perhaps that are antithetical to how it was kind of originally set or what its purported aims are.
I should just explain to listeners that ESG is basically a shorthand for environmental, social and corporate governance. They're meant to help companies be more transparent about their environmental and societal impacts. And it's become a bit of a buzzword, though in the book you take it apart very, very nicely as how it can be used and abused by companies, partly to greenwash some of their activities. I mean, I suppose one of the questions that floated around in my mind as I read the book was, are you blaming for consultancies for things that aren't their own fault? So, for instance, if you take the British system of government, one of our problems surely is the generalist civil servant, that precisely the sort of expertise you were saying should reside in government, we struggle with because we have these people rotated very, very quickly from post to post who don't really acquire the sort of deep sectoral expertise that would allow government to do without consultancies. Do you think there's an element of truth to that?
I think that's a really interesting reflection, but I would come back and say that while we do have these, you know, as you say, we do have many generalist civil servants, there are also a lot of specialists in the civil service. And I think part of the issue is, you know, this comes back to precisely what I was saying earlier, is that perhaps because of these narratives we have about government just being a kind of big grey bureaucracy where everyone, where no one has real expertise or experience and everyone's just kind of floating around pushing paper, you know, this is maybe the kind of idea that people have about government, then we overlook the expertise and the importance of the knowledge that exists within these people who are in the civil service. And, you know, I would say that also goes for generalists, you know, who are within the civil service. They may not have the kind of deep knowledge, but they may have also themselves worked on projects or cases, as the kind of terminology would go in the consulting industry, projects that would help them to be, or would enable them to be, also useful sources of knowledge. But my kind of wider point is actually this expertise does exist in the civil service often, and it's overlooked. And if it doesn't, you know, it probably doesn't exist elsewhere either. You know, the things that the public sector is doing are often very kind of particular tasks. You know, they are particular to the mechanisms of governments. Again, they require specialist knowledge. Why would we assume that they exist in Deloitte if they don't exist in the civil service? I think the assumption should be that probably this knowledge and the willingness to develop this knowledge is there. And sometimes it's useful to learn from other actors, which could be consultants, whether these big companies, but probably more likely consultants that are coming from specialist think tanks or trade union research wings or academia, or kind of boutique consultancies, as they're called. The assumption, I guess I would challenge the assumption that the civil service is full of generalists, because my experience is that it's not.
Okay. But wouldn't the perhaps cynical answer to your question about why would Deloitte have the expertise and government not be because Deloitte can afford to pay those experts three times more than government can, so ultimately it's an unfair fight?
So this is a challenge that we look at in the book, particularly in areas of technical expertise, right? So in areas like digitalization, which the UK government has had periods of being very successful at recruiting people into roles in the civil service to work on digitalization. So for example, during the years of GDS, the early years of GDS, many of those people were kind of top of their field in kind of the nascent digitalization and digital platform. So governments can do that, but there is a challenge of salaries and conditions being much more competitive in some specialist areas in the private sector. And frankly, you know, public sector pay freezes and the kind of diminishing of stable contracts and stable careers in the public sector in places like the UK is not helping that. But we know that these aren't the only reasons that people go to work. We know that pay and conditions are not the only reasons why people choose to work somewhere. So in the Danish government, where I've been doing some more research, for example, there are many people who are coming from the top technical university who could be earning three times as much in the private sector, who are kind of engineers working on climate policies. They could be in the private sector, but they want to be at the forefront of the green transition, and they see working for the Danish government as, you know, how they're going to be able to achieve that. So there are other things, but it does also require having good conditions in government and good pay in government, which unfortunately is a challenge in places like the UK.
Which I suppose brings us to a sort of broader point, which is, isn't the root of this problem not the sort of nastiness of consultancies, but the fact that a democratic argument has been lost, and that democratic argument was about the size of the state. And actually, this is not a problem of consultancies. This is a problem of proponents of a more active, a better resourced state, as you clearly are, having lost that argument here. And therefore, it's impossible for politicians to do what you're suggesting. And don't you think that that democratic argument has to come first before we can start worrying about the role of consultancies?
Great point. And I, you know, this is really gets to the heart of the argument. You know, one of the reviews we had said precisely this: you get to the end of the book and you realize, okay, consultants are part of the problem, but actually the problem is much bigger. That's really, you know, the consulting industry is a fantastic lens for looking at the problems that exist and have developed within government and within our economies and with the relationships between government and the wider economy or within the economy. So, you know, the blurb of the book says there is an entrenched relationship between the consulting industry and the way business and government are managed today, which must change. So absolutely, this is about the relationship. I always like to challenge and push back on this kind of idea of big state versus small state, because it's not actually very accurate when we look at government spending. So government is public sector spending is kind of, it has grown and grown and grown, you know, even over the past 10 years, even after the year since austerity, government spending is not shrinking in the way that, you know, we were told that it was supposed to. So the question then becomes how that money is spent. And part of the challenge then is to push back and say, well, you know, if we're spending this much on consultancies, that's a kind of distribution away from an investment in public sector capacity. We argue then, why not just invest in public sector capacity and help to rebuild some of these capabilities in-house instead of distributing it away from government?
But isn't part of the answer to that that in our current system, given the current state of our politics, investing more in a larger civil servant service is politically unpopular? I mean, almost whichever side of the, whether you're left or right, whether you're Labour or Conservative, if you wanted to come to power and one of your arguments was, when we come in, we'll spend a whole lot more on creating a bigger civil service, you're going to undermine rather than increase your chances of getting elected, aren't you?
I think, so you know, that, I mean, that's one of the things that we're challenging with the book, right? Because what governments are currently doing, which is siphoning off huge chunks of budgets across different departments to the private sector, to consultancies, most people actually don't know that this is how public money is being spent. And perhaps that would be, well, if the public perhaps is more aware of how public spending worked and where money flowed through government, then perhaps the idea of spending more of that money or and not increasing the size of government spending, but distributing more of that money towards investment in the public sector would be more popular than, you know, it currently might be. It's because we have, you know, these ideas of, you know, we, again, this return to this narrative of austerity, we need to reduce spending in the public sector, and that means shrinking the civil service. But that's, Frank, that's not what's happened over the past decade. That's not, you know, that promise hasn't come to fruition. So I think if we had more kind of awareness of how money is actually spent through government and in government, then perhaps the idea of investing or spending more of it, investing it in our kind of collective organisations of the public sector, would be much less controversial.
And I suppose that speaks to a problem that's run through a lot of our work, which is just how little the public know or indeed care about the details of how, you know, how little time they spend thinking about this is problematic. Do you think, I mean, finally, I mean, one of the things that's sort of implied through the book, do you think that the revolving door between consultancies and politics is a problem or problematic? That is to say, you either get people going into politics out of consultancies, or you get people sort of leaving politics and going into consultancies. That's got to shape incentives, hasn't it?
Absolutely. So we do discuss this in the book. It's something that since the book has come out, I reflect that it would have been good to include even more on, because one thing that has been interesting is many civil servants who have read the book and got in contact with us, many people working in the public sector, have said, I agree with everything you've said, but one of the challenges we have is that everyone from my team, you know, wants to go and work for a consultancy. And we have over the years had so many people in my team who have, you know, got all their experience, got all their knowledge, did their civil service fast stream, they've got their kind of experience, work, they've done their time, and now they're off to earn big bucks in.
Yeah, then you cash it in.
Exactly. So this is something that I think, you know, when you write a book like this, there's always more that you could explore and more that you could look at. I think this is a big challenge. Again, probably the first step to remedying it is ensuring that people understand what the consulting sector is, what it does, what the kind of challenges are with its use in government, and also, again, that when governments are employing people and having these careers, that they are doing so with good conditions and good pay, and challenging these kind of narratives about government just being fixing the market, there to fix the market, because these are the kind of things that are more likely to make people want to stay in government.
Are you genuinely optimistic about that? Because on one level, I could sort of say that sounds a bit like a forlorn hope, given where we are now, that conditions in the civil service can, I mean, even if not match, can sort of credibly compete with the private sector, or that people start to wake up to the realities of government. I mean, it would be nice, but is it really something we can plausibly hope for?
Well, it has to change, doesn't it? I mean, this isn't idealistic. This is thinking of what are the challenges in government and the way that government spending is happening today. You know, what is the alternative to what I'm saying? Is it would be okay, things just carry on as they are, and you know, maybe we tweak a few things and government spend a bit less on consultancies, but that won't fix the problems that we identify in the book, which are at the core of, you know, the bigger problems that people are experiencing around, you know, economics and issues that people are experiencing with the cost of living. You know, this is a systemic problem, as we describe in the book. So we have to come at it with systemic solutions, as well as looking at kind of how these systemic solutions affect them, the kind of micro dynamics of government, the kind of pay and conditions that people in the public sector have. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, to echo Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative to changing the way that our economies and governments are run. So it's realistic because it's the only alternative, I would say.
Right. Okay. Well, look, Rosie, I'm both slightly awestruck and indeed slightly resentful about the fact that you've written a best-selling book before you've finished your PhD. So congratulations on that. Just for the sake of our listeners, let me say, if there are any of you thinking, having second thoughts about ploughing loads of money into consultancies and looking for expertise, do get in touch with UK in a Changing Europe, because we're happy to take your checks. But for the moment, Rosie, many, many thanks indeed for that. Many congratulations on the book. I thought that was a really, really interesting discussion, and good luck with the PhD.
Thank you very much. Thanks.